From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. On today's show, we're talking all things food. As many of us prepare to bake cookies and share meals with our families this holiday season, we consider the surprising incidence of hunger on college campuses.
Then the conundrum you might face making your morning cup of coffee.
When you grind fresh coffee, it actually gives off CO2 gas. And when you grind it fresh, and drop it into the Mr. Coffee and brew, that gas kind of works the force field. It really inhibits absorption of water and extraction of coffee.
And chef and author Patty Hinnich shares her unique cultural heritage, and we learn about the bold flavors of Mexican Jewish cuisine.
To eat things such as gefilte fish, you really need an acquired taste. But when you eat gefilte fish that's cooked in a spiked tomato broth with olives and pickled chilies, you don't need an acquired taste.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. For many, the holidays are all about the food, whether it's baking cookies for Santa, frying up latkes and donuts, or simply sharing a meal with friends and family. But the holiday season is also a time when we think about those less fortunate, because not everyone is able to eat three meals a day, let alone a big feast.
College students are one of the biggest groups that have trouble getting enough to eat. As higher education becomes a goal for more kids, a more socioeconomically diverse set of students show up on college campuses in Milwaukee and around the country, forcing many schools to stock campus food pantries and rethink meal plans.
Ashley Hall is a recent college graduate. As a high school student in Milwaukee, she received free and reduced-price meals. But when she got to college, she was on her own, and finding enough nutritious food proved to be a challenge.
Hall now works as a coach with College Possible, a Milwaukee-based organization helping low-income students attend college. As she told Lake Effect's Rachel Morello, her own experiences with food have shaped how she helps her mentees today.
So I went to high school at Milwaukee School of Languages on the north side of Milwaukee, and I was really into playing sports there. So I played volleyball, soccer, a little bit of basketball. So I knew when I went to college that, like, I wanted to go somewhere that I was going to play sports. So I applied to Lakeland College, and I got in contact with a soccer coach right away, and I got accepted, and I got on the team, so I just went there.
Tell me a little bit about when you were in high school at the School of Languages. What were meals like for you during the day?
So Milwaukee School of Languages is a middle school and a high school. And when I was in middle school, they didn't offer breakfast. So I ate breakfast at home, which was cereal. But when I got to high school, they started offering breakfast as a part of your lunch package. So I got reduced lunch or free lunch most of the time. So I got free breakfast. So then I always ate breakfast at school. It was like just a routine. Breakfast, first period, lunch, fifth period, and that was just it. It just became a habit.
Sometimes there's a stigma associated with programs like free or reduced lunch. Did you ever feel uncomfortable that that was something that you took part in?
When I was younger, it felt really uncomfortable to me to, like, know that this is only for kids, that their parents don't have enough income that get placed on this. And then I thought, like, well, what are my friends going to think about me, that I don't have money? And then it came just that most of my friends were in the same bracket. They were in either free or reduced lunch too. So as I grew up into high school, I realized that doesn't make who I am. It just is a part of who I am. And I just had to learn to live with it and to make it a positive thing.
Was it something that was just in your own head, or did you have experiences that made you feel that way?
Just in my own head. So most of the time, other students didn't know if you were on free or reduced lunch. Like, I knew, so then I thought everyone else knew. That it was like a sign over my head, this person has free lunch. And unless I told people, oh, I get free lunch, people didn't care.
So how did that change once you got to college, once you went to Lakeland? What was it like for you doing meals there?
So it was completely different. When I was in soccer, it was like you get up with your soccer team and you go and you have breakfast and you have lunch together. And then when school started, I didn't eat breakfast, which was weird because it stopped becoming a routine, right? I would get up and enough time to go to class. But if I brought, like, a yogurt to class, then that was it. I didn't make sure that, like, oh, I have to go and eat breakfast. It just stopped becoming a routine.
Was that something you were getting in a cafeteria? Were you being provided that because you were on the team? Talk to me about how you got the food.
So with the soccer team, we'd go into the cafeteria and we'd have to like swipe for our meals, which we got a packet because we started early than the other students did. But once school hit, you were using your own meal swipes depending on what your package was. And my package was, I think I had like 100 meals for a semester, which is crazy to think that like, okay, so now I have to be careful. How am I spending my meals and not thinking, oh, I can go eat dinner every day and I'm going to be fine.
So 100 meals for a whole semester. That's all you had on that plan?
Yeah, that was it.
I'd have to imagine, I can't do the math that quickly, but I'd have to imagine that doesn't even add up to 3 meals a day.
No. If you add up, I had about like 115 meals that I could get food with. And then I had about $300 spending dollars that I could only use in the store.
Did you go through that pretty quickly? How quickly do you think you went through it?
My first semester, I went through it, I want to say within like the first 2 months, I was already done with the money. And my second semester, I was like, okay, I'm going to try and not spend. I think I lasted until about the third month.
Wow. So what did you do once that stuff ran out? Were you shopping for everything on your own?
Yeah, I was shopping for things on my own, or I was borrowing meals from other students that had plenty that they weren't using and using their meals.
Do you have like a ballpark estimate of how much money you think you spent once you had to do it on your own?
I think I want to say that I would go to Walmart at least once a week to get snacks for my room, and I would spend at least about $50 to $100 at least.
Every week?
Every week.
And what kind of stuff were you able to buy?
I would buy things to make sandwiches, so like bread, peanut butter and jelly, ramen, which is like for sure a college thing to buy.
Yeah, definitely.
And I would buy fruit snacks or like chips or things that would quick that I could just take and run.
How does that stuff compare to the stuff that you were eating when you were swiping for meals in the cafeteria?
It definitely didn't fill me up. Where like when I was swiping for the cafeteria, it was a buffet. So like I could go up whenever I wanted to and not have to worry about not getting full. We're like making a sandwich, I was constantly eating, or ramen, I was constantly eating, constantly hungry.
Right. And did you, when you were, I guess, paying for all this extra food while you were a first semester freshman, how were you paying for it? Were you working for extra money to pay for it? Were you calling home, or how, give me an idea of
how
that was.
So I had an on-campus job that would also like help me, but it was enough to go by, but I was only working 10 hours a week. It really wasn't anything, and I was working at minimum wage, so like $7.25, which wasn't enough. It was enough to kind of get me by, but it just wasn't working. I had money saved up, and I was just spending the money that I was supposed to be saving to spend for like books or whatnot. And as a freshman, you're not realizing that this money that you're spending isn't supposed to be spent the way you're spending it. So it definitely was hard. My second semester, I definitely was like, I have to fix something. I have to do something. It just came to spending wisely and figuring out when you can eat, what meals. Are you going to eat lunch today and dinner, or are you going to eat just dinner? A lot of times I would just figure out what I could do to like hold myself over to dinner, or just eat some things that I had in my room, like ramen for lunch, and then wait till dinner.
Mm-hmm. Was there a food pantry on campus that you could take advantage of?
No.
Do you wish ever that you had had something like that?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So we're talking about your freshman, your first two semesters, right? How did things change as you moved through school?
My sophomore year through my senior year, I worked at the coffee shop on campus, which one, I was spending less of my money because I was getting the coffee for free for working there, and I was getting snacks there for free. So that definitely helped me not spend money. So it definitely helped. And then my senior year, I was working in the cafeteria. So I was then a food server. So if I would work for dinner, I'd get dinner for free because I was working.
That was probably a huge deal, huh? That whole meal.
Definitely. So it helped me to figure out, well, where can I get in? Like, if I'm working at this job, then that's going to help me save here. Like, if I'm working in the cafeteria for dinner, then I'm saving my swipe for dinner. I can use that for more lunches.
This sounds so different than what you were just describing in high school, that it was all right there. You didn't have to think about it. And this took a lot of thinking, it sounded like.
Definitely, yeah.
Wow. How, now that you've graduated, congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
You just graduated last fall, right?
Yeah, I graduated in December.
How has your life after college been? Have you continued to sort of have to try to figure things out, not a semester by semester anymore, but how is it different?
So I moved back home. So my grandparents own a duplex, and my husband and I live above it. but it's still like we're on our own. So it definitely came a time where we were still living like college students, not making dinners like we should be, or not going out and buying groceries like we should be. And I think it really took us a flip of the switch to basically be like, okay, we're adults. We have adult jobs. We have to stop living like we're still in college and going and buying groceries and coming home and cooking full meals where we can have leftovers and have those for lunch and not going to like Qdoba or wherever to get lunch instead.
Do you guys do budgeting or anything like that?
We do budgeting now. So now it's like, okay, this is how much we're getting paid and this is groceries. When we weren't budgeting, it was, oh, well, we'll just go and buy whatever groceries we think we need. And it just was no organization.
So the kids that you work with College Possible now, do you guys talk about food as in terms of the larger scope of what they have to consider when they're picking a school?
That hasn't come up. I don't tell them, oh, you have to think about it, like meal plans and all of this, because I don't want to scare them right away.
When you go back and think of your overall college experience, how high on your list of like worries or stress would you rank food compared to like homework and all that other stuff?
That would probably be like my third thing. School's all obviously going to be a high stress because that's what you're working with the most. But when you run out of meals and you can't figure out what to do for dinner, then that's definitely going to be another high priority. School takes a high priority and you're forgetting that like college is also supposed to be fun time.
And then food, third on the list.
And then food.
Ashley Hall is a coach with College Possible. She spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Morello.
Coming up, we'll look at the seemingly countless ways to brew a simple cup of coffee. That's coming up when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Anyone who's ventured into a third-wave coffee shop like Stone Creek or Colectivo can tell you this. There seem to be a million ways to brew a cup of coffee. There's the French press, the mocha pot, those ever-popular pour-overs, and the list goes on. But what really makes them different? Does coffee brewed with a Chemex or Hario really taste all that different from your average drip brew machine?
Stephen Schulman is an independent coffee consultant and a licensed Q-grader who has been working in the coffee business for more than 3 decades. He knows a thing or two about coffee. In her research, Lake Effect producer Joy Powers found there were dozens of brewing methods she'd never even heard of. So she asked, can you estimate just how many different ways there are to brew a cup of coffee?
I wouldn't even start. It's kind of a running joke we have in the industry. Every at least once a week, we're seeing something new pop up. Although, let's really look at it. You know, there may be some different variations, but I think many of the brewing methods that we're seeing are different variations of drip brewing, is what we're seeing a lot of in the hand pour. And the drip brewer is basically what we'll see at, in most restaurants. It would be our Mr. Coffee machine at home, and it would also be the hand pour brewers that we're seeing.
So would those be the main categories?
Drip brewing would be your main category for brewing. I mean, even a single-serve cup that's out there, let's say a Keurig or something, is a version of drip brewing where water is flowing through the coffee for an amount of time and coming through. So your Chemex, your Hario's, where people are now, if you go to a third-wave independent coffee bar, where they're actually pouring the water by hand over the coffee grinds, that's really the same a manual process of drip that's done mechanically through your typical coffee brewer.
Now, here's a question for you. As a coffee expert, if I handed you a cup of coffee, would you be able to tell how it was brewed?
That could be a little challenging. Probably could pick up a French press because the press is a completely different style of brewing than a pour-over or a drip method. So it's going to have a significantly different profile to it, both in its weight, its mouthfeel, viscosity. So I should probably be able to pick that up. Espresso, something brewed through an espresso machine, which is brewed under pressure, likely would be able to tell that. But in the different brewing methods, not so much. However, interestingly, if you took those different brewing methods, those drip brewing methods, and had the same coffee brewed by the same barista by three different methods, let's say Chemex, Tarrio, Kalita, and use the appropriate different filters that go to each of those brewers, you definitely will pick up a difference.
How do they differ from perhaps, you know, the more traditional drip brew that I think of, like a Mr. Coffee?
By having a hand brew, you're allowing the brewmaster or the barista to have control over the process. So they're able to lengthen it, shorten it, and bring out for each particular coffee the characteristics that it's offering. And that's the best way, that's the best thing that comes from that, is the artisanal act of brewing now becomes a part of the process.
When we think of hand brewing, what are the different methods that are most often used?
The most popular is the Chemex, which has been around since the 50s. Real interesting story there. Peter Schlumbum, who was a chemist, actually just took some laboratory equipment, designed a glass brewer, and used laboratory filter paper and created the first Chemex. And that's been around since the 1950s. In vogue now is the Hario, which is, again, a pour-over. It does very well. You can now see those in many retail shops for purchase, even William Sonoma, Le Sieur La Table, as well as even Bed Bath & Beyond will now have Hario drippers. And those are the two best known. And then the other one is Kalita, which is also quite popular so far as a hand brewing system.
And what makes these different?
The two biggest difference is going to be, number one, the shape of the brewers, whether they're cone-shaped or they're flat-bottomed. That's one big thing. But the truly biggest difference is going to be the filter and the filter paper, the quality of it, the porosity of it. So whereas the shape of the brewer itself, flat-bottomed, coned, or the number of holes at the bottom, is going to affect the speed in which the coffee or the water will pour through the grinds themselves. However, also the porosity, of the filter paper and the thickness is going to affect the flavor. Chemex, which is, again, this laboratory-grade paper, is very thick. And generally, we find that it will help eliminate some acidity. It'll diminish a little bit of acidity, which big, bold, acidic African coffees, you know, can kind of tame them a teeny little bit, make them more elegant, really come through beautifully. Whereas if you do the same coffee through the Hario, you may pick up a little bit more of that brightness, the wininess, those beautiful, acidic, pleasant acidic notes that we like to see in coffee.
So what I think of as being sort of the traditional way of making coffee, I think of, you know, the Mr. Coffee. When I was researching it, though, before 1970, the percolator was really what was in vogue.
Right. And that was probably, once again, out of the 50s or 40s, you know, pre-World War II, the percolator came into play. But the percolator is kind of goes against everything we think about nowadays in specialty coffee and better coffees. You know, it's bringing the coffee up to a high temperature, the water up, excuse me, but it's constantly taking the coffee and re-putting it over. So the brewing process starts, and you're bringing it back over the grinds again. So in today's sensibilities, we might look at that with putting our nose up just a teeny little bit. However, at the end of the day, if you love percolated coffee, then that's the best cup of coffee you're ever going to have. You know, it's always a personal preference. But to the modern-day barista and looking for more purity, especially in better coffees, we're getting much more clean, elegant flavors out of these hand brews and even just typical any kind of filter-brewed coffee. And actually, hand brewing goes back, the Melitta actually goes back to the 30s as well. So even good old-fashioned Melitta has been around quite a long time. Again, it's just Melitta filter paper differs from the Hario filter paper, which differs from the Chemex filter paper. Melitta is probably the most porous, but again, it's a matter of preference and trying them all out.
So I was at a store last night. I saw several different mocha pots on sale, which to me reminded me of the percolator. How does that compare to a percolator or compare to any of these other kinds of brewing methods?
Well, mocha is kind of a hybrid, and it's closer to an espresso type of brewing because if you'll notice when you look at these mocha pots, they're very heavy duty, and that's because you are putting them stovetop or perhaps they do have, I believe, some electronic electric versions of these, but they're basically brewing under pressure as well. So yes, you're having the temperature and the time that the grinds are in contact with the water, but you're also adding pressure. And that's going to give you a much more intense flavor and pull really absolutely everything out of the coffee. So when you're ever in a position like that, the better the coffee, the better your results are going to be in those situations. You know, anything that brings out a lot of flavor will bring out the negatives and the positives. So the more positives they are, the more pleasant that experience will be for you.
Well, that makes sense. And that gets to another question I have. You know, if you're someone like me who really just has at home, you know, a Mr. Coffee maker, and you want to make the best cup of coffee you can with your Mr. Coffee, how do you do that?
Well, just keep in mind, the challenge of the Mr. Coffee and most residential coffee makers is the temperature. And that's been the kind of the issue with them. There are some better machines out there nowadays coming out that do reach 200 degrees. 200 degrees is our optimal brewing temperature. You know, so we really want something minimum 196. And most home machines won't get to that. So that's important. But there are machines that run about $100 to $150 to get that ball started that will give you that temperature. And that's a big part of the battle. But even if we're just using a good Cuisinart or Mr. Coffee-style machine, any of these, the key is going to be two things, the quality of the coffee and the quality of the water. Coffee is 98% water, so without good water, you're going to affect your coffee quality. And without good coffee, you're never going to get a great cup. So those are the two things you want to make sure are right. If you want to take your good old Mr. Coffee machine and say, okay, let's say we're going to use some, some spring water or some bottled water, purified water, great. Then we want to look at the quality of the coffee. So then there's the debate, do we grind the coffee? Well, here's the problem with grinding fresh coffee. When you grind fresh coffee, it actually gives off CO2 gas. And when you grind it fresh, and drop it into the Mr. Coffee and brew, that gas kind of works the force field, and it really inhibits absorption of water and extraction of coffee. You're kind of leaving something behind. And that's why when you do these hand pours, you absolutely want to fresh grind the coffee, but part of the process of brewing them is to do what's known as a pre-wet or a pre-infusion, which is where you wet the coffee, you allow it to bloom, which degasses it immediately, and that takes about 45 seconds on average, and then you go through your process of drip brewing. Your typical Mr. Coffee won't allow for that. So what I recommend, if you want, even with good coffee, and this will be up for debate, but my feeling is that using a good burr grinder, not a blade grinder, but a burr grinder, and grinding your coffee small amounts the night before or the day before, and using it within 24 hours, maybe even 48 tops, will allow the coffee to degas so that when you do put it through your system, you'll be able to get those flavors out of it. It's kind of a fun experiment to do is if you go ahead and grind some coffee up in the morning and then the very next and put it to the side, and the very next day brew two pots next to each other, one freshly ground and one that was ground 24 hours previous, and don't see if you see a tremendous difference in the flavor that you're able to get. The advantage of a hand pour is that you're able to grind immediately, brew immediately, and all those aromatic volatiles that are being released by the grinder, you'll be able to capture much more of them in the cup.
That's very interesting because it's a little counterintuitive. You think fresh and you think, you know, that's better. Most of the time with food it is, right?
Well, it is, and that's absolutely true. However, you know, the idea of fresh brewing, fresh grinding, is something that was developed late 60s, and it was kind of, it was basically built on perception. And it was something that was done for commercial use in food service, where there had been a prepackaged ground coffee had been the norm in that. And then it became, somebody did some advertising, and that's why there's been the creation, actually, of computerized machines. So if you look at coffee machines in a lot of restaurants today and in coffee houses, they will have a pre-infusion. They will have things that will accommodate what's going on in the hand pour. And that's going on, too, right now, is at the higher end of the spectrum for the home, you can buy a machine that will do a pre-infusion, a pulse brew. You can design the length and actually build a recipe for individual coffee within a drip machine so you can get that convenience. But those are several hundred dollars. Pro $600 to get to those levels for home brewing. But yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing. And again, there's very much room for debate. Purists would want you to grind fresh and brew fresh. But that's why the hand brew is working out so well. That's why espresso, you want to do the same thing. Because you're brewing under pressure, you can grind freshly to get all those aromatic volatiles. And you want to grind and brew immediately. With drip coffee in the home, however, that degassing period is going to be a problem for you if you're not going to do a regulated pre-infusion.
And my next question is about cold brews. We're seeing cold brews pop up on really commercial menus. I mean, Dunkin' Donuts has a huge campaign about their cold brew right now. Where does that fall into all of this?
Well, that's going to be an exciting thing. It's something that's been around, again, since for quite a while. You know, it used to be known as the toddy brewing system, and it's something that I think is here to stay. I think people have discovered it. It definitely lowers your acidity, gives you a much sweeter tasting coffee. Hot brewing brings out acid. Now, it's not a negative thing. It's just these are different styles. And some people will claim that by cold brewing, since you never really use hot water to brew, that when it's cooled over ice, it doesn't affect the flavor nearly as much. Also, because you're brewing, you're bringing out less acids, and different levels of oils are not released. You're getting a sweeter flavor out of it. So it makes, because it comes out a little bit concentrated, it is also making for something that's just perfectly suited to go over ice. Since the new generation has discovered it and they like it, don't see it going anywhere. And what you're going to start to see now is technology coming into place where they're actually almost on-demand cold brewing using pressure, where maybe you can get 8, 10, and 15-minute cold brews done. And that's for the home that are being offered now, and I think we'll see commercial applications for that as well. So cold brew, interestingly, though, there is no true definition of that, and the Specialty Coffee Association of America actually has its standards committee working on that right now to really define, you know, what a cold brew is. Basically, we assume that it's coffee that's brewed ambient temperature. Some people are even experimenting with waters, you know, that are absolutely been refrigerated or close to freezing, waters at 40 and 50 degrees. So it's really an interesting time in coffee with what's going on.
Well, it definitely sounds like a very exciting time to be a coffee drinker, especially here in Milwaukee. Stephen, thank you so much for joining me.
No, thank you for having me. Appreciate your time.
Stephen Schulman is an independent coffee consultant and a licensed Q grader. He's been working in the coffee business for more than 3 decades. He's also the former director of business development at S&D Coffee & Tea, the largest coffee and tea supplier to restaurants and convenience stores in the United States. Schulman spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
After the break, Mexican chef and author Patty Hinnich shares her unlikely journey to the upper echelon of the culinary world. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The classic images of Christmas so often include food. Families sitting serenely around a table filled with food. Santa Claus climbing down the chimney with a picturesque plate of cookies awaiting him.
For some, these familiar scenes set the standard for the ideal Christmas experience. But as Lake Effect essayist Megan Schultz explains, real life doesn't often imitate art.
In a Norman Rockwellian holiday picture, the aproned mother would be smiling sweetly, mixing bowl wedged in the crook of her arm, whisking the batter while her children vied for her attention at her side, begging to be the first to press the cookies. In normal real life, it's my sister mixing the dough with a wet towel wrapped around her head and yesterday's makeup smudged below her eyes. She's just out of the shower and is determined to make 3 different kinds of cookies with our children, aged 4, 3, 2, and 1, all before nap time. And it's already noon. I am her assistant for the annual Christmas cookie bake. Neither of us are wearing an apron, but we are both sporting our oversized, overstretched maternity tank tops from Target that we still wear on a daily basis, despite neither of us having been pregnant for almost 2 years, three in my case. She doesn't have a rolling pin, so we makeshift a wine bottle, and thankfully she drinks cabs and not pinots, and I get to tossing flour directly onto her kitchen's granite countertop, quickly judging with a finger swipe that it's clean enough. We have this idea that the kids will flock to us once they see how much fun this Christmas cookie tradition will be, perhaps arguing over who will get the reindeer and who will get the candy cane cutter, anxious to be a part of the action. Instead, we are begging them to enjoy this. "Come over here, sweetie. Don't you want to taste the dough?" My sister sings songs in her high-pitched, happy voice to her daughter, who's playing on the floor with her cousins. My niece hardly looks up. "Hey, buddy, come see these cookie cutters," I say to my son. "Which one do you want?" Hoping the word cookie will lure him to me. It works, but only for a moment. He walks toward the table where I've laid the cutters, but gets distracted by his cousin's Doc McStuffin stethoscope along the way and turns his attention to these newfangled earplugs and his own heartbeat. In the end, the kids cut one or two cookies apiece and eat at least four or five in raw dough alone. Though we probably should be worried about salmonella, neither of us blink at this, perhaps because we're eating just as much of it as the kids, only we pretend otherwise, eating ours on the sly. In the end, it's me and my sister making 5 dozen cookies while the grandparents and husbands laze around her living room, entertaining the kids, watching cartoons, asking if we need help with no intention of actually helping should we say yes. We're laughing, wiping the flour from our faces, scraping the dough off the floor, and swearing when we've discovered we forgot to set the timer and we've burnt an entire tray of sugar cookies again. "Mmm, these are just the way I like them," my husband says, eating a few crispy brown reindeer straight from the cookie sheet to make my sister feel better. My sister is 9 years younger than I am, so by the time she was old enough to appreciate the rituals of the holiday season, I was gone. I don't remember baking with her or caroling or decorating the tree, though of course we would have overlapped for at least a half a dozen years before I left for college. And no doubt I returned home for the holidays for a few years at least until I moved overseas and only made it home sporadically. So perhaps we're baking these cookies today for ourselves and not for our own kids, for the childhood we missed together. When I look over at her with the flour all over her faded yoga pants, there's a part of me that wants to bust out with a chorus of Irving Berlin's Sisters song made famous in White Christmas. We all have an idealized vision of what the holidays will look like when we have our own children. And of course, it never turns out like the picture. But sometimes, just sometimes, it's better.
Lake Effect essayist Megan Schultz is a writer who lives on the east side of Milwaukee. She's a contributing writer for MKE Moms blog and has had her work published on Brain, Child Magazine's blog, and elsewhere.
For someone who didn't set out on a career in food, Patty Hinnich has certainly gone places. She grew up in Mexico in a Jewish-Mexican home, and after moving to the U.S. with her husband, initially pursued a career in international relations.
But life had other things in mind, as we'll hear from her in a moment. Hinnich today is the resident chef of the Mexican Cultural Institute in Washington, D.C. She hosts the PBS series Patty's Mexican Table, and she's even cooked at the White House.
Her latest book is a celebration of all things Mexican food has become in Mexico. Mexican Today features recipes from contemporary Mexican cuisine incorporating all the various ethnic traditions that have been taken in under the Mexican umbrella. Patty Hinnich stopped by the Lake Effect studio to chat earlier this year. Welcome to the show. It is so nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me here, Mitch. Very happy to be in Milwaukee.
Well, I want to start maybe decades and decades ago because I'm really interested to hear the story of your family's immigration to Mexico because I think it's one we probably don't think about much in this country.
I think so, too. I think people tend to see Mexico as very unidimensional, just a mix of native Mexican with Spanish, the mix of the intermarriage of old world, new world in very simple ways. But Mexico is much more of a complex mosaic and melting pot than people think. So not only is there the old world mixed from the Spanish conquerors and they, you know, they had the Mexican colony for 300 years, but there's a French, there's an Italian, there's a Middle Eastern that's very strong, has very strong enclaves in the weirdest of places. I just went to film in Yucatan and found a huge Lebanese community.
Really?
But also, oh yes, gigantic. I know, I was just as surprised, and I'm Mexican, and I've been to Yucatan many times. But also Asian influence, strong. I mean, the Chinese since the 1500s. And just as well, the Jewish settlers, the Jewish people have come to Mexico since the 1500s when they were kicked out of Spain and many decided to jump on those ships. And as marranos, you know, as converts. And since then, there's been an influx in different waves of Jewish people to Mexico. And my grandparents were some of those.
When did your grandparents immigrate to Mexico?
So on my father's side, they were Polish from tiny Polish settles, you know, tiny little towns. They were peasants from Polish land eating potatoes and herring. And they arrived in Mexico before the Mexican Revolution. They were very, very young, so early 1900s. And the wave they came in from was the one that was running away from pogroms. And then on my mother's side, it was later during the Second World War. My grandfather was Czech, very handsome man. He was a little bit of a womanizer, but very handsome. And then my grandmother was from Austria. And you know, they found ways to settle in Mexico and to weave the European foods with the Mexican foods in beautiful ways.
And it's hard in some ways to imagine a more different place to go than Mexico, especially compared to Poland, but certainly, you know, what was then Czechoslovakia and Austria. I don't necessarily think of a similar climate, environment, access to the same kinds of foods in Mexico.
I know. It's fascinating. And, you know, they were all trying to get into the U.S., but they couldn't because of several reasons. You know, the wave that came fleeing from the Polish pogroms, they had closed the Polish quota. And the ones that were trying to come in when the Second World was happening, it was the Jewish quota. There was always some kind of quota. But they found their way to Mexico through the port of Veracruz, and which is a fascinating area in Mexico where a lot of that, you know, intermingling of cultures has happened. And they were fascinated with Mexico because think about my grandparents were Ashkenazi Jews. My grandmother from Austria had a very complex upbringing in terms of food. You know, Austrian food and pastries are divine and complex and beautiful. But my Polish grandparents grew up on boiled potatoes and herring. So they were absolutely fascinated with Mexican ingredients, with the warmth, the colors, the flavors. And so I always say that the Jewish Ashkenazi food in Mexico, there is something as Mexican Jewish food and has existed for centuries, has been blessed and really lucky to have found a place in Mexico, because to eat things such as gefilte fish, you really need an acquired taste. But when you eat gefilte fish that's cooked in a spiked tomato broth with olives and pickled chilies, you don't need an acquired taste.
I was going to ask how the two food traditions inform each other. If I were to go to a Passover Seder or Shabbat dinner in Mexico City, what would it taste like? I mean, you gave us a flavor there with how gefilte fish is different, thank heavens. But how else does Mexican, you know, the more traditional foods of Mexico inform Jewish foods?
You know, it is a fascinating topic. I mean, in terms of Jewish food, but all foods, I think that Mexican cuisine is so strong. It's such a strong mother cuisine. It has such strong pillars that it has the strength and the power to welcome new cuisines and influences and ingredients and sort of bless them and incorporate them into its, you know, like with open arms, transform them, give them the Mexican stamp in a blissful way. And, you know, you have Mexican pasta, you have Mexican sushi, you have Mexican pizza, you have, and in that same way, you have Mexican Jewish food. And the results are, I mean, exquisite. As what Mexican, you know, Mexican gastronomy and cuisine does, it transforms meals or dishes that can be pretty bland into sexy, you know, spicy, seasoned, happy, colorful. So meals in my grandparents' homes were absolutely, you know, irresistible, delicious. Matzo balls, my grandmother used to make matzo ball with a very clear broth, sitting on a bed of steamed wild Mexican mushrooms, steamed with cilantro and jalapeño, just delicious. My other grandmother used to make her chocolate babka with Mexican true cinnamon and Mexican chocolate. So it's just what Mexican gastronomy does, just make it richer.
Do people keep kosher in Mexico?
Some do. Most don't.
I would think with such an emphasis on pork yes. and shellfish, and it would be difficult.
It is difficult. And the Jewish community, you know, as you know, has very different ways to express itself and to grow roots, you know, depending on which country the Jews establish themselves in. In Mexico, it's very ironic because the Jewish community is very divided. You have the Ashkenazi Jews, then you have the Sephardic Jews, but then you have what we call the Arab Jews, which are the Jewish families that have come from Lebanon and from Syria, and they're very divided. You have the Shamis and the Halabis, and an intermarriage is considered intermarriage, you know, between an Ashkenazi Jew and a Shami Jew. And they have, you know, very different schools and synagogues and very different ways in terms of cooking.
At the same time, I gather you grew up like a middle-class kid anywhere might have. I mean, it sounds like a lot of stopping by your favorite street carts with your siblings or friends. What kinds of foods did you gravitate towards besides the, you know, the traditional foods that that might be at on a holiday plate?
I didn't grow up inside of the Jewish community in Mexico, ironically. I mean, my grandparents were Jewish. We celebrated Shabbat, you know, on Fridays, but that was the only thing we did. I didn't go to Jewish school. I didn't go to a JCC. I didn't at all. So I always felt like I was living between worlds. I was always attracted to, and still I am very attracted to, messy foods. I love messy. I have a sister. I come from a family of four girls, and everybody's into food. One of my sisters, she's a fabulous French-trained pastry chef. And everything she does is, you know, super perfect and tailored and measured. And I am just like, bah! You know, like I want messy. I want to eat it all. So I love hot dogs and hamburgers and pizza and guisados and tacos. And I like messy. That's what I like. And I have three boys, so it helps
me. So that works out well, yes.
Yes.
Well, and so, I mean, so your own story of how you became a chef and kind of a go-to chef at that is pretty interesting as well. I mean, you had already done pretty well for yourself in policy work. What was the spark that got you going towards this other part of your life?
I am a crazy eater. I'm hungry all the time. I love food. The way I experience
it. Well, so am I, but I'm still in radio.
Yeah. Okay, I'll tell you what I think triggered it. When I moved to the U.S., I got married to my husband. I was 23 years old. I used to feel I was so mature. But now I look at photos and I tell him, what did you do? You took me out of that crib. But anyway, we moved to Texas, and he had to work a lot and travel a lot. We didn't have kids then, and I was writing my thesis, you know, locked in a duplex most of the time. And I was very nostalgic. I was very homesick for Mexico and for my family and for the tastes and the dishes that nurtured me. I really felt, I mean, this sounds depressing, but I was like sad and lonely. You know, I was in Texas and it felt like Mexico, but not. There were Mexicans, but not. There was Spanish, but sounded different. All the restaurants that said Mexican food were not. So I felt like I needed to start doing it for myself and by myself at home. So that's why I started cooking. And once I started cooking, I loved it. And I felt like I needed to continue with the path that I had set myself, you know, towards being a political analyst, being an academic, trying to help the world with some ideas in a small, meaningful way. And so I kept yanking myself back to being a political analyst. But I had some some experiences in the food world. I've always loved public radio and public TV. So while I was writing my thesis, I found a way to volunteer in the PBS station in Dallas, and it happened to be a cooking show. And I was so happy doing that. And my husband told me, Patty, you need to go into food. Look how happy you are. And I was like, no, I'm not going to go in the kitchen. I need to work and make a, you know, I come from divorced parents, and my mom has always told me two things. One, never trust any man, even if it's the man you married. and I married a great man. And two, always make a living for yourself. Like, you have to be self, whatever the word is in English.
Self-sustaining.
Self-sustaining. Yeah. And so I was like, he wants me to be dependent. He wants me to be, I'm not, I'm going to. So I was very rebellious in that way. But I really always loved cooking. But I stubbornly continued.
I'll be a policy analyst.
Exactly. Exactly. And he's not going to drag me in the kitchen. But anyway, I did a master's in Latin American studies and then worked in a think tank. And I always had this thing with food. And I did, you know, special programs that focused on chocolate or pastry or bread in the local cooking school. But then one day I was at work and a coworker told me that he was Peruvian, and I had to do a policy research paper explaining the differences between the transition to democracy in Peru and Mexico. Serious topics. And I was doing that research, and my coworker, who was Peruvian, said, hey, by the way, you know that Peruvians, we have the best ceviches. And I said, no, you're talking to a Mexican. We have the best ceviches. And he's like, no, but we started making ceviches first. I was like, no, you're wrong. And so instead of researching on the democratic process, I started seriously researching on who got to ceviche first. And after 5 or 6 days, I had written this great article about ceviches in Latin America and the differences between Peruvian and Mexican ceviches. And I came to my boss and I said, I think I'm of no use to you. I think I have to write about food. And I mean, I had struggled for a year not being happy at work.
Well, and I wonder, as you're talking about this, whether there isn't some deep-seated similarity in what you were maybe going to accomplish as a policy analyst and what you are accomplishing in what you do as a food writer.
You know, when I was in my 20s, I wanted to be an academic and help with ideas and something that would help Mexico and help change the world. And, you know, one is an idealist. And now I get emails from somebody telling me, Patty, you know, your fish tacos are a go-to. They save me, you know, on Mondays when my kids need something to eat. And so I feel like I can touch people's lives in a more meaningful way, even if it's with a taco, you know? And I love researching recipes when I get emails or calls about people saying, you know, my grandmother came from Zacatecas and I've never been there, but she used to make these piggy cookies and I don't have a recipe. I'm like, you know, sent on a mission to find those recipes and you know, find ways to connect bridges between communities and generations and people. And I know there's a ton of people doing that. And the more that we do it, I think the richer we are.
There is a section of this latest book that might surprise some people who might be picking up a Mexican cookbook and thinking that they're just leafing through traditional Mexican recipes. There is a section on hot dogs.
Yes.
Which, and you've already said that you love hot dogs, but maybe it gets at something that we probably don't think about much here either. The idea that just as Mexican food might be coming here with some level of Americanization, there are American foods that have become Mexicanized.
I'll tell you, Mitch, you get a lot of complaints from people here in the U.S. that I call them, and they're called Mexican purists, those who say that you can only find fabulous Mexican food south of the border, and to have Mexican authentic food, you have to kneel on the ground and grind that, you know, corn masa for tortillas. And
like Tex-Mex is a swear word.
Yeah, like Tex-Mex is a swear word. And I feel like the more that years and years pass, the more that you see phenomenal Mexican cooking in the U.S., and there's even regional kinds of Mexican food in the U.S., and I always tell people who say, oh, no, no, this is the bastardization of Mexican food. I always say, have you been to Mexico and have you eaten a hot dog and a hamburger? Because Mexicans have always been obsessed with the U.S. We have these complex love-hate relationship. We want to have the American dream in Mexican soil. We want the Levi's jeans. We want the Hollywood movies. We want the Coca-Cola. You know, it's, and but we also are very proud about our Mexicanness. But right next to every amazing taco stand, there's an amazing hot dog stand. We love hot dogs. We love hamburgers. We love pizza. And I'm not making it up for that cookbook. You know, Mexican-style hot dogs and hamburgers and pizza have existed in Mexico for a couple centuries.
Well, Patty Hinich, it's I feel truly blessed to have spent this time in the studio with you. Thank you so much, and I hope you come back and see us again.
It will be my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Patty Hinich is the author of the cookbook Mexican Today, New and Rediscovered Recipes for the Contemporary Kitchen. She's also the resident chef of the Mexican Cultural Institute in Washington, D.C., and she's the host of Patty's Mexican Table on PBS. We spoke with her in August. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I hope you'll tune in this weekend, Saturday and Sunday at 3 for our special holiday all-music edition of Lake Effect Weekend. That's coming your way tomorrow and Sunday right here on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
In the meantime, stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.